I want to express my appreciation to Dub and the elders here for their stand for the truth for throughout the years of this lectureship and even before. For the continuation of this lectureship, it has been a great aid and rallying point for faithful Christians for years. And we do appreciate it and the work which is done both in the lectures here verbally, but also in the books that are published. They are a great aid and help to those as we work in local places and to others. So this is greatly appreciated. Dub said we wouldn't turn down any money for the Shield of Faith. Well, it's about to the opposite point. The issue that went to the publishers this past week has a note in it that unless we raise $250 a month more in monthly support, the paper will be ending with the December issue. So if any of the congregations would like to engage or help engage in a good work, then we would certainly stand ready and willing to take your money. The text for our study will be the first two chapters of Esther. The book of Esther is an important and interesting study. It reveals to us events of how God spared His chosen people, Israel, from annihilation. Just think with me for just a moment. If they had been wiped out of existence, the nation of Israel, before the Christ came into the world, how world events would have been different. No Hebrew nation, then there is no Messiah. No Messiah, then a lost world. We would all be eternally doomed to an eternal punishment. And thus, the book of Esther becomes a very important book for our study. It is God sparing this nation. And even though the name of God is not mentioned in the book, yet God's hand, through His providential care and concern, is certainly seen through every page of the book. We start off in the first 9 verses of the first chapter with the feast of Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is King Xerxes, the son of Darius Histopus. He ruled the Medo-Persian Empire from about 486 or 5 B.C. to 465 B.C. Ruled over the area, we're told, from Indus, the Indus Valley or India, to Ethiopia. There were 127 provinces over which he reigned. A province is any area which had a governor. He was seated on the throne in the capital city of Shushan, the ancient city of Susa, now called Shuster by the Persians. And in the 3rd year of his reign, he makes a feast in which he brings all of his princes and servants to Shushan. The custom of Eastern kings was to give very elaborate feast to display their power, their wealth, their beauties, or all the beauties which they had gained. This feast for his princes and servants lasted for 180 days. At the end of that feast, he then gave another feast for all of the people, which lasted for 7 days. During this feast, the king waived the required drinking amounts to allow them to drink however much or however little that they desired. During that same period of time, Vashti made a feast for the women, she being the queen. The name Vashti in Persian means beautiful or excellent woman. And as we see the development of the first chapter, we see that Vashti certainly is a woman that deserved the name of Vashti, an excellent or beautiful woman. Now verses 10 through verse 12 then, We have the king's request and Vashti's refusal to come. The king, in showing off all of the magnificence, all of the beauty of his empire to the people, to the princes and servants, it comes toward the end now of this feast, and he wants to show off another beauty that he has, and that is his queen, Vashti. Show her beauty to the gaze of these drunken men. And so he orders his seven chamberlains, or eunuchs, to bring Vashti to appear apparently unveiled before the men to show off her beauty. But that was contrary to all standards of decency. In this, you begin seeing a little bit of the pride of Ahasuerus. And we need to realize the sin of pride within our own life. In Proverbs 11 and verse 2, we're told, when pride cometh, then cometh shame. In Mark the 7th chapter, verses 22 and 23, he mentioned several things, pride among those things, and said, all these evil things come from within and defile the man. Well, here we start seeing the pride entering into Ahasuerus. He was a prideful man, showing off all of his magnificence, all of the beautiful things which he possessed. And now then, gets to the point, there's nothing else to show. So he decides, I'll show my queen and her beauty to the people. The results of pride are seen in throughout the scriptures. For example, in Obadiah, verse 3, that the pride of thine heart hath deceived thee. Pride deceives people. It certainly makes them feel more important than they really are. In Proverbs 29 and verse 23, a man's pride shall bring him low. So it brings a person low. While he thinks he is elevating himself through the pride, it actually brings him low. And Daniel 4 and verse 37, Nebuchadnezzar learned the sin of pride and what it will do because God abased him. And so God will abase those who are prideful. In Proverbs 16 and verse 18, one that we know so well, that pride goeth before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. So pride brings destruction and falling. And in Psalms, the 10th Psalm, verse 4, we're told that the wicked, through the pride of his countenance, will not seek after God. God is not in all his thoughts. That one who is prideful will not seek after God. God is not a part of his life. God is not needed, he thinks, within his life. He can do everything on his own. His beauty, his magnificence, his power, his own self can do everything that is ever needful. And thus we see the principle given throughout the scriptures, the need to humble ourselves under the mighty hand of God that he may exalt you in due time. 1 Peter 4, verses 5 and verse 6. But this command that Ahasuerus gives was also the unreasonable demand of a drunk. They had been drinking for 7 days. How much, we don't know, but apparently and from all indications within the text, these men were drunk. Alcoholic beverages first attacks the mental sensibilities and moral sensibilities of a person. Very possibly, if it were not for the alcoholic beverages, the drinking that Ahasuerus was doing on this occasion, Ahasuerus never would have made such an unreasonable demand of the queen. It dulled his moral sensibilities. The Bible has ever emphasized to us and enjoined man to be sober-minded. Sober-mindedness as opposed to not simply being not drunk, as we think of being sober, but sober-mindedness, right thinking. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse verses 6 through verse 8. Or 1 Peter 5 and verse 8 tells us to be sober. Well, that's sober in thought. Because our adversary, the devil, is a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour. We've got to be sober-minded, sober-thinking. Yet, alcoholic beverages, the very first thing it attacks and destroys is that moral sensibilities of man. The moral right and wrong that man possesses. It takes away that sober-mindedness that is necessary to withstand Satan. Now, we all recognize that the Bible very clearly condemns the sin of drunkenness. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 10, for example, along with the works of the flesh in Galatians 5, along with other passages of Scripture. But let me state unequivocally that the Bible also condemns what we refer to as social drinking. I mentioned two passages of Scripture that gives evidence to this. Leviticus, the 10th chapter, verses 8 through verse 10. It says that the Lord spake unto Aaron, saying, Do not drink wine nor strong drink, thou nor thy sons with thee, when ye go into the tabernacle of the congregation, lest ye die. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations, that ye may put difference between holy and unholy, between unclean and clean. Let me first suggest to you in this regard that while the Lord was speaking to Aaron and his sons, the priesthood, that today all Christians are priests. And the purpose of this command, do not drink any wine or strong drink for those who are priests, is to make a separation, to put a difference between that which is holy and that which is unholy. Well, brethren, what are we as Christians to be today? Are we to be holy or unholy? Reading of 1 Peter 1, verses 15 and 16 clearly answers that question. We are to be holy. Well, here in the Old Testament, God, in relationship to Aaron and his son, says, if you drink wine, if you drink strong drink, any at all, then you're unholy. You are unclean. Would not the same principle apply today for us as priests of God? Well, certainly it would. And let me just mention very briefly Deuteronomy 29. And verses 5 and verse 6 teaches that those who are led by God will not drink wine or strong drink. They will not drink alcoholic beverages. You can also study along that line passages such as Proverbs 20 and verse 1, Proverbs 23 verses 29 through 32, Hosea the 4th chapter and verse 11, Matthew the 24th chapter verses 48 through 51, and that in relationship to John the Baptist greatness being, or no, that one's in relationship to those who drink and associate with those who are drunkards will not inherit the kingdom of God. Luke 1:15 is in relationship to John the Baptist and his greatness being in relationship to his abstaining from alcoholic beverages. But then we would also look at the evils that are associated with drinking. In 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 22, we are told to abstain from the appearance of evil. Well, if the drinking of alcoholic beverages to excess and drunkenness is sin, then if we are to abstain from the appearance of that sin, then certainly we should abstain from any alcoholic beverages whatsoever. In 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33, we're told to be not deceived. Evil companionships corrupt good morals, American Standard puts it. Well, that which is associated with drinking is totally evil. The consequences of drinking are death, disease, heartaches, destruction of homes, property, crime rates go up, crimes of all sorts committed as a result of drinking and in association with drinking. Those who are Christians will not touch, come close to, they will not associate with alcoholic beverages of any kind. Queen Vashti refuses this request of Ahasuerus. She knew that refusal to come at the king's request and command would certainly bring certain consequences. There are certain consequences that are associated with the actions that we perform. We all recognize that to be true. We teach our children that principle. Well, Queen Vashti knew it, that Ahasuerus, being an absolute monarch, could do anything he desired with her. He could have put her to death for her refusal. Yet, it is important to realize that Vashti had the courage of her convictions. Brethren, I wish a lot of Christians today would have the courage of their convictions. We allow the liberals to run up and down the world today, and we say nothing, we do nothing about it so many times. We refuse to take a stand, we'll sit back and do nothing and allow them to take over and take control. Realizing that if we start standing up and if we start saying things, that we're going to be labeled troublemakers, mossbacks, and all other sorts of evil names by these loving brethren. And so we sit back and do nothing. Vashti is one to be emulated because she had a courage of conviction. She was not willing to allow her decency, her dignity to be stamped upon and looked upon by drunken men. And that, whatever retribution might come. Courage of conviction. We need to realize, though, even in the world today, that same principle. We are going to suffer for righteousness' sake if we are living righteous. The Bible has always told us that those in darkness hate the light. They're not going to come to the light, and in their hatred, they're going to bring persecution and suffering to those who are in the light. This is true especially in relationship to Christians when he is taking a militant stand for right. Because in that militant stand for right, he is going to expose the evil deeds of others. That's why Ephesians 5:11 teaches us, not simply have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness. A lot of us would like to stop there. But it doesn't stop there. It says, but rather reprove them. We've got to expose those evil deeds. How many of us do it, though? We walk into a store that we frequent, and there's the filthy, lewd pornography that's on the newspaper stands. Do we say anything about it? Do we do anything about it? The X-rated shows come in, the peep shows and such like come into town. Where's Christians and their voice against the evil? Brethren, we need to start taking a militant stand against these things. When we do that, then those in darkness are going to start persecuting those who are righteous. That's why Paul would tell Timothy, yea, and all that live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. And yet we talk about, well, we don't suffer persecution today. Well, there's good reason, probably. Now, reason is because we're not living as God would have us to live and taking the militant stand against the evil that God demands. But let's also mention in regard to this that the reward for righteousness far outweighs any evil that they might bring upon us. That's the teaching of 1 Peter, and especially chapter 3 and verse 13, when he says, who is he that will harm you if ye be followers of that which is good? God will be on our side, Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. And thus we should have the boldness to stand. And when eternity comes, God will take vengeance upon those who do punish and persecute us. Romans 12, verse 19. Well, Vashti refused to show off her body to these drunken men. She had some decency about her, that even though she had a command of the king, come and display your body to the gaze of these drunken men, she refused to do so. Well, today, sad to say, many women do not need any command from anyone. They don't need any reason whatsoever, but they're going to display their body to the view of the men and women of our nation. The Bible instructs us as to how to dress in 1 Timothy 2, verses 9 and 10, says, in like manner that women adorn themselves in modest apparel with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with broided hair or gold or pearls or costly array, but which becometh women professing godliness with good works. In 1 Peter 3, verses 3 and 4, whose adorning, let it not be the outward adorning of the plaiting of the hair or the wearing of gold or putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart and that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. Now, specifically, the problem addressed in these verses is overdress. Yet the principles that are set forth for overdress apply to that which we have a problem with today, which is underdress. But if you notice the terms that are used, the word modest, the word means well-arranged, seemly, modest. Trench writes of this word, the well-ordering is not of dress and demeanor only, but of the inner life, uttering indeed and expressing itself in the outward conversation. Yet to limit our discussion, as we so many times do, to the word of modest, might it be an injustice to us. Because so many times we use the term in a subjective way. Although the term is not subjective, we use it that way. And so we'll talk about, well, what's modest to one person is not modest to someone else. As if modesty is something to be based upon our subjective nature. And to what many refer to as modesty would be basically whatever society becomes or approves of. What is fashionable. When that's not modesty at all. But then he uses some other terms there that we also need to notice. Shamefacedness. The word means a sense of shame. And it uses, in fact, the term modest is used in defining this word, or reverence. And so we're told that this type of attitude will precede and prevent the shameful act and restrain a good man from an unworthy act. It is an inward attitude that reflects itself in outward dress. There is an inward attitude of the heart that because that heart has become pliable to God, that it's going to prevent that which is shameful, and that includes in the area of dress. And then sobriety. Trench writes about this word, that it is the habitual inner self-government with its constant rein on all the passions and desires which would hinder the temptation to those or to these arising, or at all events from arising in such strength as would overbear the checks and barriers which shamefacedness opposed to it. Sobriety defines the boundaries that are pleasing to heaven, to pleasing to God, over which we must not pass. Now then, the question becomes, does the Bible give us some principles concerning the clothing that we wear? I believe indeed that it does. When we go back to the very beginning in Genesis, the third chapter, Adam and Eve were naked. After they ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they realized their nakedness, and so they sewed fig leaves together because they were naked. And it says that they made for themselves aprons. Word aprons there is most often translated girdle. It was at least an attempt on their part to cover certain parts of their body. But then we're told in verse 21 of chapter 3 that apparently what Adam and Eve had made was not sufficient, because God made them coats of skins. In fact, during this interval from the time that they had made their aprons to the times that they made the coats from skins, they were still described as naked even though they had clothing on their bodies. Notice verses 10 and verse 11. So God made coats to clothe them. But the word coats comes from a Hebrew word which refers to a garment like a tunic, which, according to the Hebrew lexicon of the Old Testament, generally with sleeves coming down to the knees, rarely to the ankles. Well, do we start learning something about God's view of decency and morality in relationship to our dress? I believe indeed we do. Only after God made a clothing for Adam and Eve, which covered from the neck to the knees, were they described as being clothed. Prior to that time, they were described as being naked. In Isaiah 42, verses 2 and 3, I would urge you to study that as well, because there it teaches also, or describes individuals, those going into captivity, whose thigh would be uncovered, and it says that they are naked. Brethren, we have a problem in our society today with dress, and it's made its inroads into the church. When women can go out and feel no shame by wearing the bathing suits, the mini shorts, the mini dresses, and such like, we have a problem. Much of today's clothing is intended to appeal to the fleshly desires of man. The designer who made the miniskirt famous said, "Am I the only woman who has ever wanted to go to bed with a man in the afternoon? Well, there are lots of girls who don't want to wait. Mini clothes are symbolic of them." Shouldn't that tell us something when the designer of those type of clothes tell us, here's the design of these clothes, here's the purpose and intent of them, and then how can we as Christians wear such? Paul Harvey reported a result of a survey made of top law officials in all 50 states. Responding to the question, does the short skirt invite sexual crimes? And 92% of them responded yes. They know what the problem is, but many times we can't see it, or we refuse to admit it. There is a letter to Ann Landers from a 17-year-old boy. And I'm going to read the letter, and he says, "I have had enough of you. I am a 17-year-old boy who thinks your advice to the girl whose steady boyfriend has wandering hands is all wet. Instead of telling girls to give the eight-handed idiot a clop in the chops, or however you worded it, why don't you put the blame where it belongs, on the girl? No guy in his right mind ever starts to paw a perfect lady. The chick who suddenly finds a guy's hands all over her had asked for it, in one way or another. Sometimes it's not in the words, it's in the way a girl gets herself together. The mini skirts are a pretty good eyeful when a girl is standing up. When she's sitting down, it's like she's wearing a bikini. No normal guy can look at all that flesh and not get ideas. Transparent blouses and sweaters and jeans that fit like sausage casings are worn to get guys excited. He wants to do more than just look. So please, Ann Landers, since you're supposed to give advice, give it to the girls. They are the ones who need it." I don't accept all that he says, even though a girl might ask for it. As he puts it, it's not right for a man to give it to her, using those terminology, yet don't miss the principles that are set forth. The clothing that so many wear today is wrong and sinful, and it produces those things. And brethren, we as Christians need to start speaking out against it. And we start needing to set some standards of decency for the nation, not follow the world, not be conformed to the world, and not look to Hollywood and to the fashion industry to set our standards for us, but we are the ones who need to be upholding the standards of right and wrong, and we have not been doing it. And those women who start wearing such, and let's also apply it to the men, because the men have a problem as well in this area. Men need to be modestly dressed just as much as the women. And when they get out of that line, then something needs to be done by elders and congregations to bring them back to the decencies and standards which God has demanded. Christians need to make sure that their clothing reflects the image of God and not the image of the world. Verses 13 through 20 then, there is some advice given to Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus appeals to the wise men and the seven princes. Wise men were astrologers and magi who gave advice based upon the stars. Brethren, so many today go to the horoscopes, to the palm readers, and such. And basically that is a form of determinationalism. It denies the free moral agency of man. It says all your life has been determined by the stars. There's nothing you can do to change it. Well, that's wrong. It is anti-God and anti-Christ. The seven princes were privy counselors who were always admitted to the presence of the king. They were the ones who were skilled both in law and in judgment. Now notice that they wanted to make sure first that all things were done according to the law. Oh, how commendable that is. Man is to respect the law. We're to respect man's law, whether it be our government, whether it be city, county, state, and our government, even with some of the things which they do, still must be respected and obeyed, even though some of the decisions that they make are ungodly and wrong. But we must first and foremost, brethren, respect the laws of God. That's the principle set forth in Acts 4th and 5th chapters when the government said to the apostles, don't preach anymore in the name of Christ. Peter and John's response, we ought to obey God rather than man. First and foremost, we must obey the laws of God. But notice some of their observations. How that first one's influence or one's actions has an influence on others. And that's true whoever we are and whatever we do. Paul would put in Romans 14 and verse 7, for none of us liveth to himself and no man dieth to himself. We are going to influence others. Question is, what is your influence? What is my influence going to be? Is it going to be something which will bring others to God? As Jesus taught in Matthew 5, 13 through 16? Or is it going to be, because of our actions, causing people to leave God and go away from Him? So many so-called Christians today, their actions have pushed people away from God instead of drawn them to God. But our actions are going to make a difference with others. But they also had some relationships in the home which they observed, that the husbands are to be head of the home. They recognize that principle, and that principle has been God-given. Husband is the head of the wives, Paul would write in Ephesians 5 and verse 23. Now that headship must, of course, be coupled with love. The husband is to love his wife, even as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. Ephesians 5, 25, and then verses 28 through verse 23. And 29 does not give the husband the right to be mean, cruel, heartless in any way, shape, or form. Nor does it give him the right to lead in a way of sin. Ahasuerus, in his headship of the home, was trying to lead Vashti in a way of sin. That was wrong. And Vashti was right in rejecting the demands that would lead to sin. But wives are to submit themselves to the husband. Ephesians 5, 22. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. In verse 33, he goes on to say, nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. And when a husband loves a wife in the way in which God has demanded, then the wife is not going to have any difficulty in submitting herself to the role of the husband and the rule of the husband in the home. The problem that we see so many times is the husband does not have the love and the respect for the woman that is necessary, nor does the wife have the submission and the respect and the reverence for the husband that is necessary. And so we see problems within the home constantly today. The principles of God would solve all of these problems if we would but apply them to the home. So they give the advice to banish Vashti and start looking for another queen. And so he follows that advice, and they began to search for Vashti's successor. Even though he was in no hurry, he begins remembering Vashti. Possibly the sentence against her had been too harsh, too severe. And so these advisors, let's get a new queen. And so finally we're introduced to Mordecai and Esther in the book in chapter 2 and verses 5 through 7. Mordecai had been born in captivity in all probability, but he went into captivity and under that second carrying away by being taken into carried into captivity in the person of his forefathers. It presents to us Esther, who is a Jewish orphan girl, and presents Mordecai in a good light because he now is taking care of her. He is raising her as his own. We start seeing some of the beautiful principles, and you'll have to read the book because my time's about up. You did say I had 2 hours, though, didn't you, after you got up here? We see some beautiful principles, both concerning Mordecai and Esther. Mordecai doing something which many of our brethren today will not allow to be done out of the church treasury, and that is the supporting of orphans out of the church treasury. Esther and her beautiful nature, her submission to her father, Mordecai, and that submission and that beautiful inner nature being shown so that others will be drawn to her. And finally, that is what happens. Both the king, those who are in the wife's house, and over the wife's house, are all brought to love and give things to Esther which others would not have done. And if it had not been done except for her inner beauty. And it closes the chapter with a conspiracy that's revealed by Mordecai, which sets the stage, really, for the deliverance of the Jews from the hand of Haman. A beautiful two chapters with a great deal that we can learn and should learn from them. And I certainly encourage you to study those two chapters in light of what God says and the principles that are found therein.